Good morning.
We begin tonight with an unprecedented catastrophe developing across Australia and around the world.
Breaking news this hour, a global IT outage grounds planes and knocks TV networks off air.
5 a.m. here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. It is 6 a.m. on the East Coast. Here's a live look at Philadelphia International Airport. Why are we showing you this? A worldwide IT outage has caused dozens of flights around the globe to be grounded this morning.
Businesses and institutions have been knocked offline because of a massive IT outage.
Text us this morning on 51551 if your device is still working. Who knows, we may even be able to read it.
Oh, hats off to the Darcy Show for that one, because yesterday we woke up to a world brought down by the blue screen of death.
Brian, I was saying we came in here this morning and none of the computers were working, and it was quite a job for our sound crew to get us on air. But this has been happening all around the world. What's going on?
Well, Lonnie, I can tell you I'm speaking to you on a phone line, and I normally wouldn't be. I'd be speaking to you via a different system we use in RT, which we're having troubles with ourselves this morning. In the last few minutes, London Stansted Airport saying that some check-ins are being done online. The London Stock Exchange has been hit by the technical glitch. Sky News, from a media perspective, unable to broadcast this morning. And I suppose the big news really emerging overnight, and possibly a lot to do with the time difference and the time zones, Anya, was Australia, its biggest bank.
Work and technology correspondent Brian O'Donovan for A Morning Ireland that white knuckled it to air. The phrase being bandied about, global glitch, such an innocuous term for what was a massive mess, particularly in Australia. With Philip, here's Reid Butler, a reporter with Nine News in Melbourne.
Has had a widespread impact right across pretty much every industry and sector. My network, Channel 9, we first started experiencing issues around 3 o'clock Eastern Australian time here, maybe four and a half hours ago, and it started small. We couldn't make phone calls, have meetings over our systems, and then it quickly became apparent that something was seriously wrong, and got to the stage where it was incredibly difficult to broadcast at all. Auto cues weren't working. We weren't able to send material back from the field, and we were right in the middle of our afternoon news bulletin when all of this started happening. So it's been widespread. I've been at the airport for much of the afternoon. Just chaos there. Departure screens just not even working, blacking out. People having no idea what the situation is, if they're going to leave. It was just absolute chaos there. As well, supermarkets have experienced huge issues throughout the course of the afternoon. A lot of people are doing their grocery shopping for the weekend. And we've heard reports of scenes there, people not being able to pay for those groceries, having arguments with staff who were not in the know about what was happening either. It has been, chaos is the word for it. Fools, everyone having to revert to the old-fashioned technology, being a pen and paper, and 4 hours into this crisis, and it seems to be unravelling further.
Sharpen those pencils. And all of this down to a software update from a global cybersecurity company called CrowdStrike. Here's Ronan Murphy, chairman of SmartTech.
Everything points to the fact that this was a software update, a routine software update. But what I would say is that this is a really stark reminder to the potential pitfalls of centralising systems in a single cloud
vendor.
Okay,
but hang on one second, because the thing that doesn't make sense about it being a centralised update is, why would they do everything everywhere all at once? Because usually when you roll out a patch or an update, you do it in one or two places at a time, to precisely to avoid something like this happening.
You're spot on. And that's where there's going to be very tough questions asked by regulators and governments and enterprise customers about why this third-party vendor were allowed to update their software globally everywhere all at once. And that simple software update has led to the chaos that we're seeing right now.
Okay, so are you saying that right now somewhere there is a person or a room full of people who are going, holy crap, what have we done?
You're dead right.
Ooh, do not want to be that person. By midday, a fix had been deployed to begin bringing systems back online. But turn it off, turn it back on again? Not going to work here. Here's Conor Flynn, Managing Director with Waystone Compliance Solutions, with Rachel.
How easy or how hard is it going to be to fix this?
Unfortunately, it's quite difficult from a logistics perspective, because it does require a reasonably competent technician to stand in front of a machine or give specific explicit instructions to competent users of a couple of actions to take. But every device has to be individually managed or fixed to remove this corrupt file.
From yesterday's News at One, and important to reiterate, this wasn't a cyber attack and your data is safe. But what an end to what had already been a tumultuous week for news, a frightening week in many respects. An attempted assassination in the States and here at home, violent clashes and an arson attack at a protest camp in Coolock. But let's start stateside. At the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee, the now official nominee for president, Donald Trump, made his acceptance speech.
They are coming in from every corner of the earth, not just from South America, but from Africa, Asia, the Middle East. They're coming from everywhere. They're coming at levels that we've never seen before. It is an invasion indeed, and this administration does absolutely nothing to stop them. They're coming from prisons. They're coming from jails. They're coming from mental institutions and insane asylums. The press is always on me because I say this. Has anyone seen Silence of the Lambs? The late, great Hannibal Lecter. He'd love to have you for dinner. That's insane asylums. They're emptying out their insane asylums. And terrorists are coming in at numbers that we've never seen before. Bad things are going to happen. This is going to be very bad. And bad things are going to happen, and you're seeing it happen all the time. That's why, to keep our families safe, the Republican platform promises to launch the largest deportation operation in the history of our country. Under our leadership, the United States will be respected again. No nation will question our power. No enemy will doubt our might. Our borders will be totally secure. Our economy will soar. We will return law and order to our streets, patriotism to our schools, and importantly, we will restore peace, stability, and harmony all throughout the world.
From Morning Ireland. And with Philip, this pithy analysis of that acceptance speech from Sunday Business Post's Marion McKeown.
He meandered on for about 19 minutes in total in a rally speech of sorts that was potboiler, but that was also really boring. And you could feel the energy just sort of peter out of the place at moments. It peaked when he introduced Melania, strangely, when he spoke about drilling for oil, when he spoke about a couple of other things. But overall, he kind of blew it. And he had such an enormous opportunity because the speech just went on for too long. He said nothing that was new. And he sort of digressed all over the place. And, you know, it was just a bit of a pointless meander, really. And he didn't have a very high energy level. So it was a little bit anticlimactic, I think, the end.
However, this was a politician who just a few short days ago had survived an attempted assassination. On Monday's Liveline, Joe spoke to John David Longo, mayor of Slippery Rock, who had been at the rally in Butler, Pennsylvania.
You know, we're just enjoying the experience. We're getting looking forward to hearing President Trump give his message. And then, of course, the shots ring out. And, you know, my ear immediately recognized that sound, but I never would have imagined or guessed that with all of the great security measures that go into a rally like this, and especially for one, for a president or a former president of the United States, that sound was gunfire. But shots rang out in quick succession after that first one that let me know that my worst fear was a reality. I shoved my wife to the ground and I covered her with myself. And while doing that, I was scanning the crowd around me, immediately behind me, because I knew that the fire was coming from behind me. I just wasn't sure if it was from within the venue. So once I realized that nobody was in the venue with a gun next to us, I was, you know, of course, yelling at that time for everybody else around me to get down and stay low.
Okay.
And scanning the crowd. My eyes kept going back to President Trump, of course, with my head over the barrier because I was, you know, I wanted to know if we had just lost President Trump. And I watched the Secret Service pounce on top of him to protect him with their bodies. And I saw him wrangle his arms and his head from the Secret Service to peer his head out from the huddle of Secret Service members and his fist to raise in what I can only describe as triumphant defiance to this gunman, mm-hmm. To let everybody know there that he was still with us.
From Liveline. A man at the rally, Corey Comparator, was killed by the 20-year-old shooter Thomas Matthew Crooks, who himself was then fatally shot by a Secret Service sniper. In the immediate aftermath of the shooting, leaders from across the political spectrum called for peace and unity. But as the week progressed, discussions as to how this would affect the November election. With Claire, Matthew Schmidt, Associate Professor of National Security and Political Science at the University of New Haven.
I was reading an opinion piece by Frank Luntz, the pollster, this morning, and he was saying only 4% of Americans haven't made their minds up at this stage. And he would be surprised if the events of Saturday change anybody's mind, if they've already decided, well, I am a Trump voter or I am a Biden voter. Do you think it's going to move the dial that significantly?
It doesn't have to. It has to move it a little bit. It has to move it enough in the right county, in the right state. And where it will move it is not in changing someone's mind, but in getting more people out to vote for Donald Trump than otherwise would come out. And I think the fact that he is essentially a living martyr now has a very good chance of doing that. It's definitely Donald Trump's race to lose right now. You know, he is moving towards the potential of a landslide victory. And I think that's what's really new here. It's very hard to see through the fog of all of this right now. But I think an actual landslide for him in the Electoral College now becomes possible because of the assassination attempt.
And this week also saw Trump pick his presidential running mate, J.D. Vance, a man who had once described him as America's Hitler. On Drive Time, Washington Bureau Chief for The Guardian, David Smith, gave us the skinny on the Ohio senator.
His upbringing, I think, is one of the things that appealed to Trump. He grew up in Middletown, Ohio, so a small town, America. His parents divorced when he was still a toddler. His mother struggled with substance abuse. He was raised by a grandmother who owned 19 handguns. And Vance, you know, he enlisted in the U.S. Marines. He served in Iraq. He graduated from Ohio State University and went to Yale and got a law degree. And he became a venture capitalist. And he wrote a best-selling book, Hillbilly Elegy, which was very timely. Into, you know, it was based on his own life and gave an insight into, you know, the plight of the white working class in America, these people who had felt long neglected and who Donald Trump seemed to speak to somehow. Mm-hmm. And so I think Vance will be a key player in the so-called Rust Belt states such as Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin that could decide this entire election.
But rowing back on those criticisms, how'd you pull that one off?
That was a tricky thing for Vance to overcome, but he has said again in an interview yesterday he was wrong, and once he saw Trump actually become president and serve for 4 years, that changed his mind, and now he's a big fan of Trump and the MAGA movement.
Meanwhile, a COVID-stricken Biden lies low and is reportedly soul-searching as to whether he should stay or go. Here at home on Monday, violent clashes between Gardaí and protesters in Coolock in North Dublin, where a disused former paint factory was earmarked to house up to 550 international protection applicants. On Tuesday's News at One, Rachel asked Paul Rogers of Coolock's Northside Partnership for his reaction.
I suppose shock, obviously. I suppose some element, though, of not surprised, given what happened earlier on this year in relation to the protests and the scale of those at the time. You know, it's a very challenging issue with the ongoing protest that was at the site, or the encampment, I suppose. And I do think you see the number of young people that were involved in, you know, really reprehensible behaviour in that. But I think just I don't know, were they drawn to that because of political motivations, or was it just because it was something that was kicking off in their community and they were going to be there in any way, you know? It's very challenging, you know, speaking to staff here this morning and other people across the organisation and the community, like, everybody's in shock and nobody condones what happened. But there's a lot of mixed views, I think, as well, about the site and the scale of the proposed development and stuff like that. So, I mean, from the perspective of the Northside Partnership, we do what we can to try and support the integration of members of new communities and that, but it's just quite challenging.
You were part, I think, of the group that spoke to officials from the Department of Integration back in April. Have you had any engagement with them since then?
Up until yesterday, no. Those meetings that took place back in April, where there were really just communications as to what was planned, what was going to take place. I think the department themselves were quite clear that it's not consultation, it's communications, you know. So I'm not quite sure in terms then of who's taking the leadership on it. We'll do what we can as an organisation to try and, you know, we're Northside Partnership, we work in partnership with community, voluntary and statutory organisations, but there hadn't been any further communication up until yesterday, no.
Well, the following day, Rachel put this to Minister for Integration and Green Party leader Roderick O'Gorman.
As you mentioned, the local representatives, people will have heard a string of them over the past couple of days saying that there was little meaningful engagement with the community, that there was just that one meeting with government officials and that was it. Should more have been done?
I don't agree that there was little engagement. I think we engaged early and we engaged significantly in terms of this location. As I said, our engagement began in late March, where TDs and councillors were rung and informed about the potential use of this site. There was a meeting in early April, again, with elected reps and with community reps, letting them know the plans for this location.
Just and the that one was meeting, up. Though, even though some local politicians sought further discussions.
But I think it's important to say that we haven't moved international protection applicants into this site as yet. This was at an early stage in the process. We provided significant information even at that early stage, and we'd also made it very clear that once the site was ready to be used as accommodation for international protection applicants, there would be further engagement as well, and that continues to be the position of this department. So I know we've been criticised in the past for not enough engagement. I don't accept it in this situation. We engaged early and we provided significant information, and that engagement will continue.
From the News at One, and reports this week that the government has identified more than 30 large buildings for use as accommodation for asylum seekers. So a story, no doubt, we will be returning to. But for now, back in a bit. Welcome back. Willie Clancy Summer School, Milton Malbay, Clare, Willie Week. Sessions in kitchens. And there for it all, The Rolling Wave with Aoife McCormack. Session. You'd almost be tempted to break into song.
Do you need to be a good singer?
No.
Oh, David Brophy, a man who should know better. He was on with Brendan to give us all some tips on singing party pieces. And a man who has clearly never heard some of us mangling Summertime after a few Bacardi breezers. Mary texted in.
What about people who are tone deaf? I can't hold a tune or rhythm, but I love lyrics and singing them. What does he think of me singing? Should I just stay quiet?
I've
spent my entire life encountering people who've told me they're tone deaf.
Yeah.
And I've said it doesn't exist. And I've never met anybody who, after 5 or 10 minutes, they can't get them to sing a tune.
Ooh, on your own head be it, sir. You might have a lot to answer for this summer. Every wedding in the country, it'll be 1 in the morning, the brides abandon the heels, the groom wearing his tie as a headband, your uncle just finished his Spancel Hill, and you're wondering, could you, should you? Well, here are some tips. My Way, for example. Don't do it.
If you play the song My Way in your head or sing it to yourself in your head, it's very hard not to hear Frank Sinatra's voice. Yeah. Because that's what we connect it with, you know. Yeah. And so the colour of his voice, like, there's one of the greatest singers of the 20th century, how he sings, the tone he makes, how he turns the phrase. So even though you're listening to somebody else sing, you are channeling what's been in your head, the collective memory that you all share of that song, which is Frank Sinatra singing. And you, and that, as a result, that creates not only a connection with the person singing, but a memory of how you feel when you hear that song every single time, which could have been for the past 20 or 30 years.
Duly noted. So what then should we do?
Think about what's the song you like listen to. What song you identify with? Is it the words? Is it the singer who sang it? Is it a particular time in your life when you heard the song and that had a connection with you? And try and pick a song that you connect with. I would also say, don't pick a song with a wide range and that loads of people know. So I would say, don't pick My Way, because actually it starts quite low. And at the end, you've got that very, very high. I did it my way. And if you don't nail the end of it, people kind of go, oh, you know, Uncle John there, he didn't quite hit that end of that quite right, you know, like, and they'll give you a polite applause and you're quite exposed. Then I would also suggest, pick a song that people kind of know the chorus of. So when you get the first verse out of the way and your heart is thumping at 160 beats per minute, if people join in the first chorus, that gives you a safety blanket and you kind of go, I'm not on my own now. And you can recover a bit, you know, because it is a daunting thing for many people to sing.
Yeah, and so people know as well, don't they? They know if someone wants them to join in, if they need that.
And if you just, as you've just done there, you just raise your hand and go, come on, sing along. Yeah. Everyone will sing along. They'll carry you through it, you know.
And if you do it right, you'll make your granny cry.
One of two things, or both, can happen as well, is that everyone goes into their own kind of little reveries as well, don't they? So in a way, people go into themselves. But then in a way, suddenly, as if by groupthink, they will join in at a point, maybe softly first, and then it becomes the communal, yeah?
It's such a powerful thing. Even listening to you describe it there, I can kind of feel that energy that you get. It's such a powerful thing. And I think at particularly at family gatherings where there's been a tradition of singing in generations, you'll kind of, somebody will listen to a song and go, I remember this is the one that Auntie Joan used to sing whenever we gathered on Christmas Day. So you get songs that are passed on through generations. And as I say, nostalgia and memories. And that's what, you know, every now and again you'll hear a sniffle and the odd tear drop down. That they're the special moments where people find an emotional connection that you just can't achieve any other way.
And of course, we sing to tell stories.
Have people always historically been compelled to sing together? Yeah, it's something.
Yeah, there's a really, actually, I'm just thinking of it now, it's a great book by English researcher called Stephen Mythen called The Singing Neanderthals, and it traces the origins of music in pre-humanized, in Neanderthals.
Yeah.
And he talks about frequencies and how when we speak, you know, baby talk to a baby, like, we don't, no one teaches to speak at a high pitch, but you don't go up to a 6-month-old and go, hello, little cute baby. You kind of raise your voice. Yeah. Hello, hello, little baby. And you speak.
Well, you might go up and down. You might go
up and down. Exactly. That type of thing. And that's the origins. Because babies at that age, they find higher frequencies more comforting. And that's he believes that's the origins of singing in all pre-humanoids. And obviously extending it to humans. Singing songs is an emotional connection. But also it's folklore. It's telling stories of what happened to your ancestors and your family prior to you. And so it's storytelling as well. Yeah, and some of the great stories, some of the great singing, I think, is also storytelling as well.
And that brings us nicely to last Sunday's Say a Song, a series about our Shannos tradition. Now, the song this week was Anna Cúan, a song composed by Raftery about a tragedy in 1828 when 20 people died when their boat sank on the Carib in Galway. And because this series isn't just about celebrating the old, Deirdre Ní Glacann took the song to Dublin poet Stephen James Smith, now transplanted to Wexford. And Shannos is very much alive for him.
When people emote things in the way that you get at on Goline. It's not about the quality of the singing, about the quality of the listening, but that's not to diminish the singers because they put so much heart into it. And I'd much rather somebody singing imperfectly but meaning it. And I think that's what you'll find when somebody sings Shanos, like, they mean it, you know, and it gives you access to a different pace, to slow down, to engage. Again, empathy, you mentioned, to open up to that. It sounds a bit mystical and all, but maybe it is a bit mystical. Like, you know, and what harm? Like, you know, what harm? Isn't that a magic thing that that Shanos and the oral tradition allows us back to that space and away from the fast pace of, you know, and it's all well, because we're both on the old TikToks or whatever, do you know what I mean? All that crap. But like, it brings us back to that other realm. Mm. And that's what poetry does for me. That's what art can do for you. And, you know, that's what the Shanos tradition. And that's why I tend to gravitate towards these things, because, as I say, it wasn't maybe part of my youth, but it's, I found value in it. Not that it's a transactional thing, but it's given me access to this mysticism that I needed, I guess.
And he put on the headphones and listened to Ciara Conway singing Anna Coon. And that's not all he did.
The truth is, as well, I was also, I said I was maybe a fraction down at the time, and I was microdosing.
Okay.
But along with the microdosing, I bought a little bit more. Not too much more, but a little bit more. And I took a little bit of these mushrooms, and I was wandering around Wexford Town, and I was sitting outside a cafe and trying to write something and listen. And this song just really moved me to tears. Again, unfortunately, I couldn't make it all out. But because it moved me so much, I went, OK, I'll look up what's this mean. And then when I was reading it, I was like, OK, yeah, this connects with me. Because where I am, I can see the Slaney River out my window, and I have a little harbour in front of me called Safe Harbour. And there's fishermen there each day. And I was just thinking of those people. I think it was 22 people in the passing. So that's how I kind of got into it, as it were.
To say what you feel is to dig your own grave. Fear will disappear in the presence of the brave. The poet's last words were, don't be afraid. Kindness can't be said, it can only be prayed. We can't lament forever, we must live for the dead. Upon reflection, their last words echo, what might they have said? This can't be said, it can only be prayed.
Beautiful, just a verse or two from Stephen James Smith from Say a Song. Back in a bit. Welcome back. This Sunday, the hurling final. And for today with Claire Byrne, Brian, skin in the game O'Connell, went to Blarney GAA Club.
This is the first time they have three senior players representing their club in an All-Ireland final. Mark Coleman, Shane Barrett and Paddy Power. With the village covered in bunting, some of the underage players tell me who they think is going to win.
That'd be a 50-50.
Do you think so?
Yeah. It'll be a very solid match, but it'll be enjoyable. Very enjoyable, so.
Have you all tickets now, the most important question?
No, not yet.
We're sorting that one out.
I'm going on my holidays the week.
Stop. Sure, the holiday will have to be cancelled. Yeah, where are you going on holidays?
I'm going to France, but my dad wants, because the three of us, there's five of us in the family, and my mum and sister want to stay in Paris, while the three of the boys in our family want to fly back on that day and come back.
This could be very tense.
I know.
So what's going to happen? Are you going to have a vote or something? That's 3-2, isn't it?
Yeah.
You'll have to find a big screen in Disneyland or something.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, he actually sounds a bit stressed out. They were the Cork kids, and we were noting the durations of these reports because Brian also went to Clooney Quinn GAA Club in Clare.
Cheer for you with the jersey. Is that signed by the players?
Oh, yeah, it is.
So go on, tell us, who's your favourite player?
Probably like Peter Duggan or Ryan Taylor.
You kind of had to say that, didn't you?
No. They're very good. Claire will win. Claire will win again.
How much are they going to win by?
10 points.
10 points. Yeah. There's a confident man. Yeah.
10 points. Yeah.
And have you all got a ticket?
Yeah.
What do you think of the final? Who's going to win? So what's your prediction?
Claire are going to win by 5 points.
5 points. You think? Someone told me 10 points here. So 5. And what do you think?
4 points.
Who's your favourite player?
Shane O'Donnell.
How come?
Because he's a good player for Claire, and
he's very skillful.
Yeah, he's fast.
Will you give one cheer for Claire?
Ooh, and Cork too, obviously. On Arena with Kay Sheehy, a public interview with actor Brian Cox at the Galway Film Fla. He was giving, entertaining, and very indiscreet. Magic. Here are just some of the hits. First up, taking on Shakespeare and the classics, but not like Olivier.
And there was a sort of style of acting that Olivier kind of had set up, really, more than anybody. This sort of braggadocio, my boy, we can do it like this, or we can do it like that, or we can do this and this and this, you know. And it wasn't quite me, no.
Then, roughing it in Hollywood with some action co-stars.
I remember having a conversation with Nigel Hawthorne on a plane, and he was talking about how what a miserable time he had playing second fiddle to Sylvester Stallone in a film that he did with, I can't remember what the film was called, but he was going, I said, you know, I've earned my, you know, I've come to a point. And I said, you know, Nigel, I don't think that really matters. What matters is the work itself and what you're doing. It doesn't matter, you know, the idea that you have to think about your status, I just think it's nonsense. And I said, anyway, I'll swap you Sly Stallone for Steven Seagal any day. And believe me, once you work with Steven Seagal, well...
Playing Churchill, but losing out on the Oscar to Gary Oldman.
Getting back to the Oscar.
The
Oscar you didn't receive for Churchill. Well, and of course, Gary Oldman, it was the same year, wasn't it? 2017,
Yeah. Got
it for The Darkest Hour. Seems rather unfair.
The problem with Oscar season is it's a season. The thing is, if you get your film out in June, you're screwed for the Oscars. No matter how good the film is, you get screwed. Because the Oscar season is between Thanksgiving and Christmas. And everybody tries to get the film out at that time. They didn't do that with my film, our film rather. They didn't do that. They just let it go out in June. And I knew that it was a goner straight away. And then when that rather poor film got nominated, and I mean, Gary was all right, but I was better.
And then Kay, pushing her luck, asks about playing and losing out to Tony Hopkins.
Another Oscar that was lost was for Hannibal Lecter, and of course, much later on...
Well, this is the story of my life, the man who lost the Oscar, or the man who lost Oscars.
Well, you've a lot of other awards, but Anthony Hopkins won it for The Silence of the Lambs in 1991, after you had done the definitive Hannibal Lecter in 85.
Do you want me to say anything about that?
Yeah, I'd love you to say something about that.
Well, you know, I love Tony Hopkins, I really do. And Tony, being Tony, that was an extraordinary performance, and it hit the zeitgeist of the time. Our film, I still think, is a better film because of Michael. The only thing I don't like about Manhunter is the music. With both those Oscar things, they have a different identity, really. I mean, Tony was amazing. And Hannibal Lecter can be played in many, many different ways. Churchill is a real person, so in a way you've got to acknowledge his reality much more than, you know, in a way you're more free when you do somebody like that. And also, Michael Mann wanted to do something very psychological about Hannibal Lecter. There was none of that in any of that stuff, you know. He didn't want that. That would have been completely inappropriate. And I wouldn't have done it anyway, you know, because I'm not that kind of actor. I mean, Tony is, and he's brilliant at it.
But maybe not as good as me. But then Kay asked him about Logan Roy in Succession, a role for which he won a Golden Globe. and he talked about the craft of acting by way of this question about his co-star Jeremy Strong, an actor committed to the role of Kendall.
Well, I was reading about one of your co-stars, Jeremy Strong, and when he was a child, he had posters on his wall, Daniel Day-Lewis, Dustin Hoffman, and Al Pacino. So he's very much steeped in the method.
He was, believe it or not, he was Dan's assistant for a while. So, oh yes, he was. He was Dan Day-Lewis's assistant. So I think there's a link.
And how did that sit with the four kids and Logan?
Well, it was not. Ultimately, it was fine. And the great thing about Jeremy is a great actor. There's no question about his acting. He's great. And when it comes to doing a scene with him, it's the best. You know, I loved playing with him. I just, all the other shit I couldn't stand, you know. Which is, to me, unnecessary. But he's a wonderful, wonderful actor. And he puts himself through it. And I don't think there's any need to do that, because we have to be flexible. We have to be endlessly sort of able to just buy into something which perhaps comes from outfield that we didn't expect. But what it could do is reveal something else that we thought about. You know, and I think sometimes when you do that, you cut yourself off from the possibility of growth in a different direction.
And finally, this.
But he does love his children.
Does he have a favourite?
I think Siobhan was his favourite. Ironically, if he'd gone on, I think Roman was becoming the favourite child. I think he'd given up on Kendall because of just Kendall's such a mess, you know. And Shiv can't shut the fuck up for 5 minutes. I mean, she's just, you know. I mean, she starts off brilliant and you go, oh, for God's sake. Connor is his first child. So in a way, Connor is special. The disappointment is deep, but it's long. It's long, the disappointment with him. And I think as he went on, I think Logan was beginning to really think, well, Connor has certain things which are not too bad. You know, he still loves them. You know, and there's always hope that they might get better. He's on a hiding to nothing, but, you know.
Ooh, ouchie. Actor Brian Cox on Succession, as heard on That Arena Special with Kay. Meanwhile, Petri dishes, beakers, buns and burners, telescopes, lots of sums. For UCD physicist Shane Bergen with Claire, all of these open up the possibility of beauty. And he talked about NASA's Hubble telescope.
In 1995, in December, the telescope was pointed at a rather dark corner of the sky. Something where you would think there's nothing there, right? And over 10 days, the telescope collected light on its huge mirror. It collected light that was travelling billions of kilometres from the outer reaches of space to reach that telescope. And then they developed the picture, right? And so it would have been like that kind of, speaking of the 90s, going into the chemist with your roll-up film and getting it developed to see your photographs. I guess young people listening can't.
Seven pictures of the dog
use up the film. Two or three that didn't work. No deleting photos then. But what they saw was remarkable. They saw this image, what they've christened the Hubble Deep Field image. They saw 3,000 galaxies at different stages of development from the nether regions of the cosmos. This light had taken billions of years to reach the camera in the telescope. And it was like a photograph of space and time. And it showed that for an area of space that we thought was dark, we could see this massive depth to space. We saw, as I said, around 3,000 galaxies. Each of those would have tens of thousands of stars, if not more, within them. And each star might have the promise of a planet around it and perhaps life. So imagine and that's just one tiny corner of space. Isn't it just beautiful
to
think?
You can imagine that moment when they saw those images, that they were, I would imagine, rendered speechless.
Yeah, exactly. And to see how tiny we are on this pale blue dot and all of our stuff, our nonsense that goes on day to day, yet we exist. And I think for any scientist who's looking out into space and seeing the enormity of the cosmos, that is truly beautiful.
Shane Bergen. with Claire. Can't resist that sound effect. This man has nearly 1 million followers on TikTok and Instagram, including Stevie Nicks.
Garen Noon. Good afternoon.
How are you, Keith? And how are you getting on?
See that, Garen Noon. Good afternoon.
Oh, good afternoon. A lot of people think my name is actually Garen. They think it's a pseudonym when they read it. They think it's Garen No One. They think I'm trying to be edgy. I think it's some sort of cool showbiz name. But I'm like, no, it's Garen Noon.
but they probably think you have changed your name because Garen is a name I've never encountered before in my life.
Yeah.
So where did that name come from?
So my dad was a massive Elvis fan. Like, he was absolutely obsessed with Elvis. And he wanted to call me Elvis, but my mother wasn't having any of that. And Elvis had a twin brother that died at birth. His name was Jesse Garen. And they were going to call me Jesse, but when I came out, my mother said, he looks more like a Garen. Now, Jesse Garen only had one R in his middle name, so they added an extra R for me, so it's even more unique.
Garen.
Garen.
And isn't Elvis's middle name Aaron?
Aaron, yeah, that's
which
it.
Rhymes with Garen.
Yeah, Elvis Aaron and Jesse Garen. That was them, yeah.
Right.
So there you go. So it's also the name of a very small breed of Scottish horse.
Spelled the same way, is it?
Yeah, spelled the same way. Right. And if you look it up, it says it's an undersized, useless beast. You can Google that. You'll find it on Wikipedia.
And he talked about his own background. His father died when he was young. His mother was really sick and he left school really early. And then he suffered from agoraphobia.
I'd say I was about 15 when it kicked in. One of my friends had died. Uh-huh. And that triggered this thing in me where I thought I was going to die, basically. And then I would start having loads of panic attacks. And they sort of started off where I'd have one every couple of weeks. And then they got progressively worse. And they got progressively worse to the point where I would have them 3 or 4 times a day. And they'd be triggered by almost everything. So when it got really bad, I couldn't even leave my bedroom. Sometimes I'd be like, I wouldn't be able to go to the toilet for 2 hours because I'd be having a panic attack. So so it got very bad for a while, but I did CBT then. Yeah. And so that's cognitive behavioral therapy. So you just take really small steps and it's quite hard to get out of. But one of the good things is if you are suffering with that, even though it's very hard to get through, it is one of the things that has one of the highest treatment rates. So if you go through treatment, it's very fixable.
And with the help of Veroiga and in particular Youthreach, he went back and did his Leaving Cert at 21. And he is now flying it. And all because he is delicious.
Follow me, I'm delicious. Follow me, I'm delicious. Follow me, I'm delicious. Also, enthusiasm about anything is not very Irish. Follow me, I'm delicious. I need to have a sit down. Follow me, I'm delicious.
Where did that? But it's a catchphrase, and people shout it at you now when they see you on the street.
Yeah, it's mad. Yeah, like honestly, even actually, I was out there, right. and two members of staff walk by me and go, "You're delicious." It's such a random thing, but yeah, it's.
How did it happen?
So I started posting TikToks about just over a year and a half ago, and it was really just to stop annoying people on my Instagram page with my nonsense. So I started putting them up and I got a few views on like the second or third one. I got maybe like 60 or 70,000 views. And then I thought, you know what? It doesn't take long to make a TikTok. I'll fire one up every day and see where it goes. Yeah. So I said I'd make one every day, even if I had no ideas and some of them were bleak. So one day I uploaded a video. It was it wasn't funny at all. It had no merit to exist whatsoever. So I said, what I'll do now is I'm just going to shout something random at the end. Right. So I put the camera really close up to my face and went, follow me, I'm delicious. And only about 1,500 people ever saw that video. But the people that did in every subsequent video said, why didn't you do your sign off? Why didn't you do follow me, I'm delicious? That's your thing. So they kind of forced it on me.
And it's your thing.
And it's now my thing, yeah.
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 Fantastic, but none of that explains Stevie Nicks.
I was absolutely amazed, yeah. So I was actually around the arena when people were going down. I didn't go to the gig. And they're like, oh, Stevie Nicks is on. I was like, oh, I can't believe I'm missing Stevie Nicks. I'm a huge Stevie Nicks fan. But later on, I start getting messages like, Stevie Nicks has shouted you out. And I thought people were messing with me. But then they sent me videos. She quoted my video and everything. She was like, I love you, Mr. I'm Delicious. I was absolutely shook. Yeah.
And I'm Delicious is doing really well and answering questions like this.
Can you ask him what's his favourite biscuit for dipping in the tay? That's Paul and Kilrush. Come on, the banner.
Paul, I'm going to have to tell you, you're not going to like this because I think it's too simple, but it's the chocolate digestive. Now, I know what you're saying, Paul. You'd rather a hobnob. They're a bit fancier, right? Paul, you can't afford them. They're too expensive. And also, they create a layer of silt in the bottom of the cup that I do not enjoy. It's a cleaner job with the chocolate digestive.
And there we will leave it. What a week. That is it from this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.